This is the NBC Theater. From the NBC Theater in Hollywood, an hour-length dramatization of one of James Hilton's best love stories. A story with singular significance for today. We bring you Lost Horizon, as adapted for radio by Richard E. Davis of NBC. And at intermission, it will be our particular pleasure to bring you a recorded commentary by the man behind the book, the author of Lost Horizon, Goodbye, Mr. Chips, Random Harvest, and other works that have lent pleasure and meaning to a number of our leisure hours, Mr. James Hilton. Here now, the NBC Theater version of Lost Horizon.
Cigars had burned low. We were beginning to sample the disillusionment that usually affects old school friends who have met again as men and found themselves with less in common than they believed they had. Rutherford wrote novels, very successful. Weiland was one of the embassy's secretaries at Berlin. And it was he who had given this little dinner at the Tempelhof Aerodrome. It was an exciting place. It afforded a proper setting for the telling of tales which we had picked up since university days. An English pilot in full flying kit strolled past our table and saluted Weiland, who didn't recognize him at first, but when he did so, introduced him all round and invited him to join us. The pilot was a young fellow called Sanders.
Sorry, Sanders. It's not easy identifying people in uniform. They all look alike, you know.
Rather. I know that well enough, Weiland. Don't forget, I was in Baskul.
What's so special about Baskul?
Well, where's the place anyway?
Baskul is a town up on the Indian frontier, old man.
It was just a little bit of excitement we had at Baskul when I was in the service. An Afghan or an Afridi or somebody flew off with one of our transports. It was the very devil to pay afterwards.
Good heavens, to mean an ignorant native pinched one of our ships?
Yes, but he couldn't have been very ignorant. The blighter waylaid the pilot, knocked him out, pinched his kit, and climbed into the cockpit without a soul spotting him. Gave all the signals, took off in fine style, and never came back.
Well, imagine that. Was the plane ever seen again?
Nope. And what's more, neither were the four passengers who'd gone aboard, aiming to be evacuated from Baskul to Peshawar owing to the revolution that year.
How many passengers were there, Weiland?
Four, I believe. Three men and some woman missionary.
And one of the men was the British consul.
You don't mean it. It couldn't have been Glory Conway, could it?
Why, yes, as a matter of fact. Did you know him?
Oh, yes, we all knew Conway. Why didn't you tell us before, Weiland?
I suppose that no one who ever knew Glory Conway would be surprised to learn that he had disappeared on the Indian frontier in a kidnapped plane. His right name was Hugh, by the way. Conway, he was a most unusual fellow. He had a keen mind, he spoke a dozen Oriental languages, he won all the prizes in school, then he went off to the war and won the DSC. Still, it was a shock to hear of his going like that. After dinner in his hotel room, Rutherford produced scotch, soda, and a tattered manuscript. He offered me the scotch and soda, and he held on to the manuscript. So I knew I'd have to wait for that until he told me more about Conway.
You see, old man, I'd been out in China visiting a friend in Hankow. And returning by the Pekin Express, I got into a conversation with the very charming Mother Superior of a French mission hospital. She told me about an Englishman who'd been brought in with fever. Said he was suffering from amnesia. And then she described him to me. I went to have a look in the hospital at Chungkyang.
Was it Conway?
Yes. I called him by his name, but he didn't respond at first. So I stayed with him until little by little things began coming back to him.
Did he tell you what had happened to him?
Well, that's just it. Conway couldn't remember the big thing. The experience that had jarred him loose from himself. He couldn't remember it then, anyway. Mm-hmm. But he trusted me to make provisions to take him down to Shanghai and thence on to London. Unfortunately, however, our travels together ended when he gave me the slip at Honolulu.
Oh, what happened there? Did his mind go blank again?
That's just it. The night before we hit Honolulu, it all came back to Conway. The big thing, that is. A most weird and unusual experience.
Well, he told you what it was.
Yes, yes. And I'm sure you'll agree that it fits Conway very well. The world doesn't see his kind very often anymore. A sort of Elizabethan combination of mental and physical activities. Certainly Conway was born for the magnificent adventure which began that morning on the airstrip at Baskul. Conway said the plane was waiting for him when he arrived. Said the hour must have been somewhere in the neighborhood of 10 o'clock.
My memory serves me right. It must have been just about 10 o'clock that morning on the 20th of October when we took off from Baskul for a safe haven in Peshawar. There were four of us aboard in addition to the pilot. Miss Roberto Brinklow of the Eastern Mission, Henry D. Barnard, an American businessman, and my assistant, His Majesty's Vice Consul at Baskul, Captain Charles Mallinson, a rather impetuous youth of 23 or 4, whom I'd learned to like quite a lot during his 6 months with me at Baskul. We'd all introduced ourselves, as people will in special circumstances, and then had settled back for the journey. I was just about to catch 40 winks when Mallinson pulled at my sleeve.
I say, Conway, are you awake?
Yes, I'm afraid I am. Why?
Well, I'm not an Air Force man myself, Conway, but it strikes me that our pilot isn't keeping a straight course.
What makes you think that?
Well, look down there below us. It's all mountains. I've made this trip a dozen times before, and I don't remember hitting a mountain chain on the regular route to Peshawar.
Well, why don't you check with the pilot?
Well, I decided to talk to you first.
I don't understand.
The pilot's supposed to be Fenner.
Yes, I know.
But I don't think that chap up there is Fenner.
Well, there was probably a last-minute change, a substitution.
I don't think that's it. I never saw an RAF pilot who was a Tibetan.
Good heavens, Mallinson, are you sure?
That's what he looked like to me.
Well, he looks like any other pilot from the rear with that helmet on. Or maybe he'll turn around so that I can get a better look at him if I rap on his window.
He hears you, Conway. He's turning.
My sacred aunt, it is a Tibetan.
Then he's opening the window, and he's got a gun.
There is no cause for alarm, gentlemen and lady. But I must remind you that I am armed and you are not. Please plan your actions accordingly, and all will go well. And now, excuse me, please.
Of all the cheek.
Whatever did he mean by that?
I'll tell you, Miss Brinklow. Our plane's been hijacked. Back in the States, we call a job like this kidnapping.
What a bewildering business that trip was. At no time were we offered any clue that indicated where we were being taken. But since we were so obviously in the grip of a power over which we had no control, I refused to speculate. And, as has happened to me throughout my life, my refusal to become outwardly concerned was mistaken for bravery.
I'm so glad you're taking everything so calmly and bravely, Mr. Conway. I've never been kidnapped before.
Well, neither have I, Miss Brinklow. But I do know that if it is a kidnapping, what they want is the government to pay ransom for us. And the government will, of course.
That's right, Miss Brinklow. Since we don't have to pay the money, we've nothing to worry about. We just happen to be on a picnic, that's all.
Now, let's not be bitter, Mallinson.
Oh, no, let's be happy. Let's sit here and twiddle our thumbs while this maniac carries us heaven knows where.
Relax, Mallinson. We don't like this any better than you do. But for my part, I'm going to enjoy life while it lasts. You don't think a little bit of extra danger matters much, do you?
Well, it doesn't matter as far as I'm concerned, but it might bother Miss Brinklow.
Not at all, gentlemen. We're all in this together, and I've every confidence in you.
You ever been in this country, Conway?
No, but it's the general frontier, and I remember some information from my government maps.
What do you think?
Well, it's my impression we're flying up beyond the upper Indus, judging from that range of mountains we seem to be approaching. They're reputed to be the highest mountains in the world.
If you're right, Conway, I hope our maniac doesn't try to take us across.
It would be pretty fancy flying if he tried that, wouldn't it?
Yes, but it's my guess he won't try. If we continue northwest, he'll probably search out one of the passes and take us through. But either way, it'll be, as you say, a pretty fancy thing.
Mr. Conway, we must remember that it will also be the will of God.
Sounds to me more like lunacy. I think he's going to land.
I sure hope this boy knows where he's going. This is no country for an emergency landing.
Well, he's probably planning on coming down on a high plateau.
You can't tell a thing from here. Too many shadows. Better buckle your belt, Miss Brinklow.
Thank you, Mr. Barnard. I'm quite prepared.
Well, this is it. The wheels are down.
What was that?
Are they shooting at us?
No, the tire's exploding.
Hold on, people. Here she goes. A moment later, after the plane hit, we were all on our feet, out the door and onto the ground. where we found ourselves at the mercy of a dour and savagely melancholy wind which saturated both earth and air. None of us was hurt, except for a few bruises here and there, but the pilot didn't share our good fortune. He was mortally hurt in the landing. We carried him, unconscious, out of the cabin of the plane and laid him on the ground. It was obvious that he had no more than a few minutes of life remaining. But before he expired, he gained consciousness for a brief moment.
Poor man.
A dirty heathen that tried to kill us all. That's what he is.
Now be quiet, Madison. I think he's trying to tell us something.
You...
You better put your ear down close, Conway, if you want to hear what he says over that wind.
You understand?
Yes, we understand. We go where?
You go to monastery. Understand? For food. Shelter.
Yes. We go to monastery. Where is monastery?
Close, near. In a valley, you find Shangri-La. Shangri-La?
Monastery of Shangri-La? How near? Which direction?
It's no use, Conway. He's gone.
Yes, I'm afraid you're right, Barnett. It's amazing he lived as long as he did.
What was he saying, Mr. Conway?
He seemed to be saying that we should go to a monastery for food and shelter. Shangri-La, he called it.
You ever hear of a place like that, Conway?
No, but I have heard of Tibetan monasteries in lonely places. I'm not sure what the name means, Shangri-La. But La is the Tibetan word for mountain pass.
It would seem that he meant for us to look for the monastery.
Well, he said it was near here.
Look here, Conway, this heathen fellow's recommendation seems to me all the more reason why we should avoid the monastery.
All right. But if we don't look for Shangri-La or whatever it is, where shall we go?
I'm with you there, Conway. You got any better ideas, Melanson? It's a long walk back to the British Consul at Peshawar.
And frankly, gentlemen, I don't think I could manage it.
All right. But what if this monastery is a trap?
A nice warm trap. That's for me. With a piece of cheese in it. That would suit me down to the ground.
Well, I take it then that we're all more or less agreed to the monastery. In any case, we can expect nothing here.
Well, what do you think we can expect from the monastery?
Food. Assuming we're lucky enough to find the place. And, I hope, porters and guides to get us back.
And what if they murder us?
Well, there's no guarantee against that. But as a matter of fact, murder is the very last thing one would expect in a Buddhist monastery. It would be rather less likely than being killed in an English cathedral.
Like poor St. Thomas of Canterbury.
Hey, wait a minute, folks. Oh, it looks like maybe the monastery is coming out to meet us. Look down there, at the head of the valley. A bunch of men carrying torches.
On my word, there must be a dozen or more. Look, they're carrying a hooded chair, the sort of thing priests or elder statesmen ride about in. It hardly seems warlike.
Well, we'll find out soon enough, friends. They ought to be up to us here in half an hour or so.
It occurred to me that indeed this must be Providence that caused the native party to be passing so close by in that remote section of the world. Much to my surprise, the occupant of the hooded chair stepped out and came forward to greet me. He was an elderly Chinese, gray-haired, clean-shaven. And he offered me no opportunity to display my linguistic accomplishments, for he hailed me in excellent English.
How do you do? I am from the Lamasery of Shangri-La.
It is indeed a pleasure, sir. I am Hugh Conway, British Consul at Bascule, or was until the rebels forced us out. My companions and I boarded the plane you see up there, expecting to be flown to Peshawar. But our pilot, much to our surprise, had other ideas, and flew us in this direction until we landed, somewhat disastrously, on the side of this valley.
Oh, very interesting, Mr. Conway. Has your pilot explained why he was bringing you in this direction?
No. No, he's dead from the effects of the crash.
Oh, very unfortunate. My name is Chang, if you would be so good as to introduce me to your friends.
Oh, by all means, sir. They're waiting at the plane, and I can tell you they'll be glad to see you.
Oh, indeed?
Yes, they're all eager to get back to civilization.
Oh? Are they so very sure they are away from it?
Well, what I meant was they'll be interested in obtaining porters to get back to their part of the world.
Mr. Conway, I shall be delighted to guide them back to Shangri-La. But as to specific guarantees about porters, that must be discussed. For the time being, however, let me assure you that you and your friends will be honorably treated, and that ultimately you will have no regrets.
I see. And where is your monastery, Mr. Chang?
On the far side of Kar Kal, the large mountain you see at the end of the valley. The trip is not a far one, but it is very dangerous without guides, and rather difficult physically as well. I am forced to ride in this chair. I must take care of myself. It is one of the rules of Shangri-La.
I signal for our little company to come down the valley, and I introduce them to Chang. And then we started out for Shangri-La, following for several hours a torturous pass through the mountains, sometimes hardly more than 2 feet wide. The porters handled Chang and his chair with amazing nonchalance, while at one point it was necessary to rope our people together. But presently, the ground leveled, and we stepped out into clear, sunny air. Ahead, and only a short distance away, lay the lamasery of Shangri-La. The howling wind disappeared, and in its place a gentle zephyr carried to our ears the tinkling of oriental chimes. It was, indeed, a strange and incredible sight. A group of colored pavilions clinging to the mountainside with the chance delicacy of flower petals impaled upon a crag, superb and exquisite. The floor of the valley below the mountain was hazily distant and welcomed the eye with greenness. Completely encircled and protected by immense mountains, it induced in me a momentary feeling, a deep sensation, half mystical, half visual, of having reached at last some place that was an end, a finality. While the other members of our party seemed to experience a similar ecstasy when they were informed that warm baths were waiting, as were clean clothes and hot food. Mr. Chang was our host. You seem a very fortunate community, Mr. Chang, and most hospitable to strangers. I don't imagine, though, that you receive them often.
Seldom, indeed. It is not a traveled part of the world.
You put the matter mildly. It looked to me as I came the most isolated spot I've ever set eyes upon. A separate culture might flourish here without contamination from the outside world.
Contamination, would you say, Mr. Conway?
Well, I use the word in reference to dance bands, cinemas, electric signs, and so on. Your plumbing is quite rightly as modern as you can get it. The only certain boon to my mind that the East can take from the West. You know, I often think that the Romans were fortunate. Their civilization reached as far as hot baths without touching the fatal knowledge of machinery.
A very interesting observation, Mr. Conway.
Please, Mr. Chang, will you tell us about the monastery, or as you call it, lamasery?
It will give me the greatest pleasure, madam, so far as I am able. What exactly do you wish to know?
First of all, how many are there of you here? And what nationality do you belong to?
Those of us in full lamahood number about 50. And there are a few others, like myself, who have not yet attained to complete initiation. We shall do so in due course, it is to be hoped. Till then, we are half lamas. Postulants, you might say.
I see.
As for our racial origins, there are representatives of a great many nations among us, though it is perhaps natural that Tibetans and Chinese make up the majority.
So then it's really more a native lamasery, then? And I suppose your head is Tibetan or Chinese?
No.
Oh, are there any English?
Yes, several.
Dear me, that seems very remarkable. And now tell me, what do the lamas do?
They devote themselves, madam, to contemplation of wisdom.
But that isn't doing anything.
Then, madam, they do nothing.
I thought as much. What do the lamas believe in?
I'd imagine that's rather a big question, Miss Brinklow.
Yes.
Of course, I believe in the true religion. But I'm broad-minded enough to admit that other people, foreigners, I mean, are quite often sincere in their views. And naturally, in a monastery, I wouldn't expect to be agreed with.
But why not, madam? Must we hold that because one religion is true, all others are bound to be false?
Well, of course, that's rather obvious, isn't it?
Really, now, I think we'd better not argue religion. But I must say that Miss Brinklow shares my curiosity about the motives of this unique establishment.
If I were to put it in a very few words, my dear sir, I should say that our prevalent belief is moderation. We should inculcate the virtue of avoiding excesses of all kinds, even including, if you will pardon the paradox, excess of virtue itself.
Mr. Chang, you'll excuse me if I interrupt.
Of course, Captain Mallinson. What is it?
Well, all this talk is very interesting, but I really think we should discuss our plans for getting away from here. We want to return to India as soon as possible. Now, how many porters can you supply us with?
Unfortunately, Captain Mallinson, I am not the proper person to approach. But in any case, I hardly think the matter of porters could be arranged immediately.
What do you mean by that, Chang?
The Valley people do not care for porter service, Mr. Barnard.
But wouldn't your Valley people like to pick up a little extra cash by carrying us to the outside? We'll pay, you know.
I'm afraid money is not the point in question, Mr. Barnard. I fear we have no men available who would be willing to accompany you so far from their homes.
That's not easy to believe, Chang. If your people won't go outside, how do you get the things you need here?
Yeah, how about that, Chang? The bathtub I used was made in Akron, Ohio. Yeah, don't tell me the manufacturer delivered that COD.
As you suggest, gentlemen, from time to time we do obtain certain things from the outside. By what methods and with what facilities, I am not at liberty to discuss at this time. The point of importance is that such a consignment is expected to arrive shortly by means of outside porters.
Good. Can we hire these outside porters to carry us back to India?
It is a possibility.
When do they get here? You still haven't told us, Chang.
How far in the distant future, Mr. Chang?
I think, madam, the phrase distant future is hardly appropriate. Unless something unforeseen occurs, the period of waiting should not be longer than 2 months.
2 months? 2 months in a place like this? It's preposterous. 2 weeks would be the limit.
I'm sorry. I did not wish to offend. The Lamasery continues to offer all of you its utmost hospitality for as long as you have the misfortune to remain. I can say no more.
You've said enough, if you ask me. But don't think you've got the whip hand over us. You'll soon find out you're mistaken. We'll get all the porters we want, don't worry, and you can bow and scrape all you like.
Now, Mallinson, get hold of yourself.
Captain Mallinson's eagerness to return to his home is understandable, Conway. But believe me when I tell you there is nothing to be done except wait. And now, if you will excuse me, I must see to the preparation of your chambers. Good night.
Well, suppose you all think I made a fool of myself, being so urgent.
But I couldn't help it. I think that Chinese fellow's fishy. There's something queer about this business, Conway.
And that goes for me too, Conway.
It does seem a little unusual, gentlemen, but I, for one, fail to see what we can do about it.
Well, I'm inclined to agree with you, Miss Brinklow. Frankly, if these people can't or won't supply us with porters, there's nothing to be done but wait till the other fellows come. I'm sorry to admit that we're so helpless in the matter, but I'm afraid it's the truth. And I, for one, am prepared to make the best of it.
Well, I suppose 2 months won't kill us. The folks in my hometown won't bat an eye. I've always been a bad letter writer.
You seem to forget that our names will be in all the papers. We'll all be posted missing, and our families and everyone else will think we're all dead.
Say, I never thought of that side of it, Mallinson. But it don't affect me, I assure you.
Well, really, gentlemen, as Mr. Barnett suggests, 2 months here is really nothing to fuss about. It's all the same wherever one is, when one is in the Lord's service. Providence has sent me here. I regard it as a call.
I, for one, was not prepared to accept Providence as the complete explanation for Shangri-La. Mr. Chang had told a handsome story, but it held a large flaw. And so that night, before I retired, I sought out our benefactor in hopes of finding out something more about our fate.
Good evening, Mr. Conway. I rather hoped I would be seeing you.
It's good to see you, sir. I hope you can understand Captain Mallinson's feelings this evening.
Entirely, Mr. Conway.
Well, that's very good of you. For my own part, I hope to find a minimum stay here quite interesting. But let me hasten to add, Mr. Chang, my patience has not dulled my curiosity about the porters.
They will come, Mr. Conway, as I told you, from the outside.
And the men inside?
As I explained, our valley people do not wish to go outside. They do not like the long and arduous trip.
But they can be prevailed upon to do so, though. Or else why and where were they escorting you this morning?
Oh. Well, that was quite a different matter.
In what way? Weren't you setting out on a journey when I and my friends chanced to come across you?
I regret I cannot answer that.
I see. You must have known of our arrival beforehand. And the interesting question is, how?
You are clever, Conway, but not entirely correct. For that reason, I counsel you not to worry your friends about these abstract discussions. You are in no danger. We desire nothing more than that you and your companions enjoy every moment of your stay with us.
Very well, then, Mr. Chang. I will not disturb my companions. In a personal sense, I can't say I shall mind a great deal. It's a new and interesting experience. And in any case, we need some rest.
If you are fatigued, Mr. Conway, there are not many better places in the world than our mountain valley of Shangri-La. You have made a wise decision.
Just about the only one I could make under the circumstances. But surely you must realize that I'm not satisfied with your evasive replies, Mr. Chang.
I realize that, Mr. Conway.
And I tell you now that it's my intention to take our case right to the very top of your organization, if necessary, to the High Lama.
Rest assured, Conway, our only concern is your welfare. When the time comes, your questions will be answered. As to the High Lama, it is his practice to interview all travelers who chance upon Shangri-La, but at his convenience.
I see.
Meanwhile, Conway, nothing more is desired of you in Shangri-La than that you enjoy life.
Chang was true to his word. Indeed, it seemed that nothing more was desired of us in the Valley of the Blue Moon than that we enjoy life. Barnard became convinced that the lamas were rich. Miss Brinklow set about to learn Tibetan and claimed to have discovered abundant evidence that the natives were immoral. And Mallinson had become intrigued by a Manchu girl who played Mozart, of all things. Her name was Lo Chen, and she spoke no English, which didn't help Mallinson's case, or so it seemed. I alone submitted to a rich and growing enchantment as the elegance and taste and harmony of Shangri-La revealed itself. And then one evening, Chang came to my room. He was quite excited for Chang.
Conway, I am proud to be the bearer of important news. The High Lama wishes to see you immediately.
I shall be honored and delighted to meet the gentleman. When is the appointment?
Now. I have been sent to bring you to him.
Very well, Chang. Lead the way. I'd like to meet your High Lama.
From Hollywood, the NBC Theater is bringing you a dramatic version of the James Hilton novel, Lost Horizon. And now, as a very special welcome feature of today's program, we introduce to you the distinguished author of Lost Horizon, the English gentleman whose writings have won such a special place in American minds and hearts, Mr. James Hilton.
Lost Horizon was written in London 18 years ago during the winter of 1932. That was a hard winter for the world. The lowest point had we then known it of the Depression, and already dark with the threat of war to come. About that time, it probably began to dawn on civilized man that he lived in an age of recurrent and deepening crisis, that military victories did not bring peace, that his world wars would have to be given numbers, and that nowhere on earth was there any place where the storm could be outridden. It was in this mood that I wrote Lost Horizon, and I enjoyed writing it as one may sometimes almost consciously enjoy a dream. I remember taking walks near my home and climbing the English hills with wild thoughts of Everest and Kanchenjunga. I remember hours in libraries reading tales and legends of the great missionary travelers who explored all Central Asia centuries ago. And I remember when people asked what I was doing those days, it was fun to answer that I was busy on a novel about Tibet, thus leading to the natural question, had I ever been there? I hadn't, and still haven't. And the way things now look, I don't suppose I ever shall. But when recently I saw the motion pictures that Lowell Thomas and his son took during their astonishing Tibetan trip a year ago, I had the curious feeling that I had seen that land before with my own eyes, that I had heard its voices and chants and trumpets, and had breathed the thin, icy air of its mountain passes. And a further strange thing is that I once met another traveler from Tibet, a rather odd fellow he was, and he assured me that he had actually found the lost valley of Shangri-La that I wrote about, a haven of peace and beauty hidden amidst the highest peaks in the world, and that it was all pretty much as I had described it. Of course, I can hardly believe that, but I should like to. I should like to.
Thank you, Mr. Hilton. Our radio version of Lost Horizon will continue from Hollywood after a brief pause for station identification.
So now I was to meet the High Lama. My amiable host led me up a spiral staircase which delivered us onto one of the higher floors of Shangri-La. The immediate and striking feature of this level was dry, tingling, unnatural warmth. We proceeded down a corridor and stopped before what might well have been the entrance to a Turkish bath, for it was that hot. It was the apartment of the High Lama. Chang motioned me in and then left the room, and I found myself in a dark-curtained, low-roofed apartment, simply furnished with tables and chairs, on one of which sat a small, wrinkled person, motionless. A little old man in Chinese dress. It was the High Lama of Shangri-La, and he spoke excellent English.
You are Mr. Conway?
I am.
It is a pleasure to see you, Mr. Conway. I sent for you because I thought we should have a talk together. Please sit down. Beside me. Have no fear. I am an old man and can do no one any harm.
I feel it is a signal honor to be received by you.
I thank you, my dear Conway. I thought if you could spare a little time, I'd tell you something about the history of Shangri-La. Oh,
by all means, sir. Again, I'm honored.
You will be interested to know that Shangri-La was founded in 1719 by a Capuchin friar who lost his way in the mountains and stumbled upon this valley. His name was Father Perrault.
A Frenchman?
A Luxembourger. A man of taste and refinement who discovered an ancient lamasery here on the side of the mountain. It was decayed, physically and spiritually. And Father Perrault undertook its reconstruction.
It interests me that a Capuchin friar would undertake to rebuild a Buddhist lamasery.
I don't wonder at that. But Father Perrault had a pride in his faith. That made him decide that if Gautama could inspire men to build a temple on the edge of Shangri-La, Rome was capable of no less.
I see. But what of his superiors? Did they approve?
Communication was not easy. Once a message came calling him to Rome, but it took 12 years in getting here. Father Perrault was unable to travel to Rome. He was then past 89.
A ripe old age and a full career, I'd say.
That's an interesting point, Conway. For you might say that Perrault's career was just beginning in one sense. For after he reached the age of 100, he decided that he was too old for disease and discontent. Only the everlasting sleep could claim him. And he was not afraid. So he devoted his mind to certain mystic practices, which the Indians call yoga.
Good heavens, what an amazing man he must have been.
Ah, yes. And Perrault was most successful in living out a regimen of reading, meditation, and yoga, including indulgences in the mild ecstasies of the Changbari narcotic, which grows in the valley, thus prolonging his life.
He must have lived to a fantastic age.
Oh, indeed, yes. Perrault outlived all his disciples. His attitude might be summed up by saying that since he had not died at a normal age, he began to feel that there was no discoverable reason why he should die at any definite time in the future.
Extraordinary point of view, which few of us live long enough to share.
It was a superb state which he achieved, Conway. Since Perrault no longer lived in fear of death, he proceeded to live the kind of life he always wished for, suspended in time, as it were. He devoted his mind, which had remained keen, to study. Does that idea not appeal to you, Conway?
It would appeal to any man. But what I don't understand is, if Father Perrault's disciples had passed away, who carried on the work of the monastery?
A soldier of fortune, who had fought against Napoleon's armies in Italy. A most unusual man, who wandered upon this valley by accident. His name was Henschel, and his energies were responsible for our present state of organization. His loss would have been altogether irreparable had he not completed more than a life work before he died.
He died?
Yes. An Englishman shot him. It was a few weeks after the Englishman arrived in Shangri-La He was an explorer.
What was the cause of it?
There'd been a quarrel about some porters. Henschel had just told him the important proviso that governs our reception of guests. Perhaps you're wondering, my dear Conway, what that proviso may be.
I think I can already guess. Is it that the guests of Shangri-La do not leave?
You have guessed correctly, my son.
In other words, we are to stay here forever.
Oh, I would greatly prefer the employment of your excellent English idiom and say that we are all here for good. But can you guess anything else after this long and curious story of mine?
Well, it seems impossible. And yet I can't help thinking of it. It's astonishing and extraordinary and quite incredible. And yet not absolutely beyond my powers of belief.
What is, my son?
That you are still alive, Father Perrault. According to his story, Father Perrault had been born in 1681. That made the High Lama 250 years old. At no time did Father Perrault even suggest that he had conquered decay or death, but claimed only that he had learned to slacken the tempo of the brief interval called life, by methods which were as simple in Shangri-La as they were impossible elsewhere. Then I asked Father Perrault a question which pleased him a great deal. Tell me, Father, what is the reason behind all this? Or is there a reason?
But of course, my son. We do not follow an idle experiment. Over a century ago, Father Perrault foresaw a time when men in their war lust would destroy all that is precious in the world. Every book, every picture in harmony, every treasure garnered through two millenniums.
You predict a dark age?
Yes. And when that time comes, Shangri-La will be ready. When the strong have devoured each other, then will the Christian ethic at last be fulfilled, and the meek shall inherit the earth. Then Shangri-La will be ready to lead the way to the more perfect life.
When I emerged from my interview with the Lama, Chang was waiting for me. And while he led me back to my apartment, we talked.
Well, Conway, does the prospect intrigue you?
It's almost too much to comprehend all at once. 2 centuries of life. How does one adjust to the idea?
We provide for that. There's a 5-year probationary period to accustom one to Shangri-La.
And if one does not become accustomed? Oh, I'm not thinking so much of myself as the others in my party.
The 5-year period will work wonders for them, Conway. And after that, they will be intrigued by the process of retarding age.
In 5 years, I'll be 42. Now, how long do you think I'll remain that way?
Retarding, if successful, should keep you at 40 for the next half century.
Well, that's not a bad time to remain stationary, is it? But tell me about yourself. Did you adjust easily?
Oh, yes. I came here in 1855 when I was a soldier of 22.
Then you're 97 now?
Yes.
And how long do you expect to carry on?
I have prospects of perhaps another century or more.
I see. And suppose you were to leave the valley now, what would happen?
Death, if I remained away for more than a very few days.
The atmosphere then is essential.
There's only one valley of the Blue Moon, and those who expect to find another are asking too much of nature.
Another question. What about those who do not adjust easily? What becomes of them?
Those who leave the valley are permitted to go, but usually they return. Those who attempt to cross the mountains have died in every case. Nature is too much for them.
And the unhappy ones who stay?
They learn happiness. The little Chinese girl who plays Mozart was one who was, shall we say, a little more than averagely reluctant.
I see. What were the circumstances of her coming here?
Let me see. She was on her way to her wedding when her party became lost in the mountains. She was the first bride-to-be we ever had.
And when was this, Mr. Chang?
1884. She was just 18.
Then Lo Chen is now...
To quote an American phrase, Lo Chen is pushing 70. Oh, here we are at your apartment. enough talk for tonight, eh, Conway? We've plenty of time for that, eh?
Yes, we've plenty of time.
Well, Conway, you must have had a thorough chat with the head man.
Oh, I did. I'll tell you all about it one of these days, but we've plenty of time.
I'd like to meet that old boy. I suppose he's one of Shangri-La's mysteries they aren't ready to unravel just yet. But I don't care. I unraveled my own little mystery tonight.
Oh, really? Which one was that?
Well, first, what do you know about Barnard? I mean, who he is and so on.
Well, not much more than you do. I understand he came from Persia and was supposed to have been an oil prospector.
Ever see his passport?
Well, I suppose so. Why, what are you getting at?
Barnard is traveling on a forged passport. He isn't Barnard at all.
How do you know that?
He dropped his wallet today, and Chang picked it up and handed it to me by mistake. Some press clippings fell out and gave the whole story away. Barnard is really Chalmers Bryant.
Good heavens. So we have an international financier in our midst.
More like an international crook. He's wanted back in the States for $100 million investment collapse.
Oh, dear me, no wonder he was so cheerful about the flight and his stay here. He doesn't want to go back. Yeah, I can't say that I blame him.
Well, now the question is, what are you going to do with him?
Well, you're not suggesting I put him under arrest.
Well, he's a thief. And you're the British consul.
Yes, yes, but for the time being, I think I can claim to be off duty.
Well, all right. That's the way you want it.
That's the way I want it. Not for his sake, but for ours.
Well, don't say I didn't warn you, old man. By the way, what's the hour?
About 10:30, I guess. Why, are you planning to catch a train?
Well, no, hardly that. I've got a date with a girl who plays piano.
Lo Chen?
Yes. She's sweet, isn't she, Conway?
Yes, terribly sweet. By the way, what do you two talk about? I mean, she doesn't speak English, and you don't speak Chinese.
Oh, I look at her, and she looks at me. We sort of get the idea across. How old do you think she is, Conway?
I really couldn't say. Why don't you ask her? Fortunately, I had Chang to talk to. He was a wise and understanding companion at a time when I couldn't discuss my knowledge of the secret of Shangri-La with my fellow travelers. They were to be told by the High Lama at a time of his own choosing. Meanwhile, my pleasure in my new discovery was marred by Mallinson's interest in Lo Chen. I was afraid he would take it very badly when he learned the truth about Shangri-La and the proviso which would prevent our returning to the outside world. Chang remarked about my deep concern.
You are troubled, Conway.
Yes, about Mallinson and Lo Chen.
You are afraid they are in love, is that it?
I'm afraid of what their love can lead to when he finds out.
Do not concern yourself. Love in moderation is quite suitable. And besides, Lo Chen will not respond with any degree of passion. That is more than you could expect. I speak with some authority, for I was in love with her myself when I was much younger.
Oh, were you indeed? Did she respond then?
Only by the most charming appreciation of the compliment I paid her, and by a friendship which has grown more precious with the years.
In other words, she didn't respond.
If you prefer it so. It has always been her way to spare her lovers the moment of satiety that goes with all absolute attainment.
Dear me, that's all very well in your case, but what about the attitude of a hot-blooded young fellow like Mallinson?
My dear Conway, Lo Chen is expert in soothing the sorrowful exile. She calms desire to a murmur. Hers is a delicate and lasting accomplishment.
And one, I assume, which she has much skill in performing.
Oh, decidedly.
In that sense, then, you could regard her as a part of the training equipment of the establishment?
You could regard her as that, if you wished. But it would be more graceful and just as true to liken her to the rainbow reflected in a glass bowl, or to the dewdrops on the blossom of the fruit tree.
Yes, I entirely agree with you, Chang. That would be much more graceful. That evening, at dinner, Mallinson's place was empty. He was having dinner with Lo Chen. But Miss Brinkley was on hand, and so was Mr. Barnard, who surprised me no end.
You know, Conway, I'm not so sure that this wouldn't be a nice little place to settle in.
Tell us why, Mr. Barnard.
Yes, by all means, why?
Well, Brother Chang took me down in the valley today, and what I saw, you wouldn't believe. Gold deposits all up and down the valley.
Oh, you don't say. Worth much, do you think?
Millions. And what's more, Brother Chang said I could prospect all I wanted. There's a fortune down there.
Well, it seems to me that you might have found more than that in Shangri-La, Mr. Barnard. Remember, there are things more precious than gold.
Well, I'll go along with that part of it, too. Besides, I feel good, get lots of exercise, and I got no worries. Moderation, you know. That's the motto here.
And I take it you've had better than a moderately good time.
Nothing like it. Better than Florida. This place suits my taste to a T. And that brings up something else. I might as well tell you folks, now that we're on the subject. I've decided to give the porters a miss.
Are you serious, Barnard?
I certainly am. I'll just wait for the next trip. That is, if the monks will take my word that I'm still good for my hotel expenses. Oh,
so you're not going. I'm surprised.
You'd better brace yourself for a second surprise, Mr. Conway. Because I think I shall stay, too.
You don't say so.
Come again, Miss Brinklow.
I've been thinking over the way things happen to bring us here. And there's only one conclusion I can come to. There's a mysterious power working behind the scenes. Don't you think so, Mr. Conway?
Oh, yes. Yes, very definitely.
So I asked myself, who am I to question the dictates of Providence? I was sent here for a purpose, and I shall stay.
You don't mean you're hoping to open a mission here?
Not only hoping, but fully intending. I know just how to deal with these people. I shall get my own way, never fear. There's no real grit in any of them.
Later that evening, I was again called to the apartment of the High Lama, and I was happy to inform him of the decisions made by my two friends.
What you tell me is good, Conway. We have done our best to make both of them feel at home. Miss Brinklow wishes to convert us, and Mr. Barnard would also like to convert us into a limited liability company. Harmless projects. They will pass the time quite pleasantly for them. But our young friend Mallinson, to whom neither gold nor religion can offer solace, how about him?
I don't know. He's going to be a problem.
I'm afraid he's going to be your problem.
Why mine, sir?
Because, my son, I am going to die.
What do you mean?
Well, surely, my friend, we're all mortal. Even at Shangri-La. All I know is the simple truth. Already I see the end. And I realize that I have time for only one more thing. Can you imagine what that is?
I cannot, sir.
My son, you are not ripe in years, but I perceive that your wisdom has the ripeness of age. Surely some unusual thing has happened to you. I've never met your like before.
Oh, there's not much mystery about it. That part of me which seemed so old to you was worn out by intense and premature experience in the war. I belong to the classification 1914-1918.
Oh, you were unhappy about the war?
No, not particularly so. I was excited and suicidal and scared and reckless and sometimes in a tearing rage, like a few million others, in fact. I got mad drunk and killed and lechered in grand style. It was the self-abuse of all one's emotions, and one came through it, if one did at all, with a sense of almighty boredom and fretfulness. That's what's made the years afterwards so impossible.
A difficult education. What have you learned?
Well, that's hard to say. Perhaps that the exhaustion of the passions is the beginning of wisdom, if you care to alter the proverb.
That also, my son, is the doctrine of Shangri-La.
I know. It makes me feel quite at home. I feel I understand you.
That is my feeling. And I have waited for you, my son, for quite a long time. I've sat in this room, watched the faces of newcomers, listened to them, always in hope that someday I might find you.
I'm honored.
I wanted to warn you of the storm that is coming to the world. There will be no safety by arms, no help from authority, no answer in science. It will rage till every flower of culture is trampled, and all human beings are leveled in a vast chaos. Such was my vision when Napoleon was still a name unknown. I see it now, more clearly, with each hour.
And you think all this will come in my time?
Yes. It is my hope that the airman with his load of bombs will pass us by. And when the new world stirs among the ruins, hopefully seeking its lost and legendary treasures, they will be here, my son, hidden behind the mountains, in the Valley of the Blue Moon, preserved by a miracle, for a new renaissance. I place in your hands, my son, the destiny of Shangri-La.
The glow faded from the High Lama's face, and there was nothing left but a mask, dark-shadowed and crumbling, like old wood. The eyes were motionless, and as I watched, it came to me that the High Lama was dead. I made my way through the dimly lit halls of Shangri-La, where, as on the occasion of my first meeting with the Lama, Melanson was waiting for me. He had important news. The porters were waiting outside the pass. Lo Chen had arranged our escape, as he put it. She was out there now, on the other side of the pass, waiting for us. And so I told Melanson the secret of Shangri-La. And, needless to say, he didn't believe me.
I really don't know what to say, Conway, except that you must be mad.
You really think I'm mad?
Well, I should say so, after a tale like that. I mean, well, really, such utter nonsense. It seems to me rather beyond arguing about. Now, look, come on, old man. I'll need your help getting over that tight spot in the pass. Let's get out of here.
I'm afraid I can't go with you, Melanson. I've absolutely no desire to go back to that life at all.
Well, I'll take it over what we've got here, penned in with a pack of old men. Even if you said what you said were true, I'd still want to get out.
Melanson, won't you think it over?
I thought it over while you were spinning that wild tale of yours. I want no part of your Shangri-La. They warned me about you at Bascule, and I thought they were wrong. But now I can see they weren't.
What did they warn you of?
They said you'd been blown up in the war. And you've been a bit odd at times ever since. Well, I'm sorry, Conway. I shouldn't have said that.
No, that's all right. It's probably true. But it doesn't alter my decision to stay. And Lo Chen should stay with me.
What? Stay here and waste her life with a bunch of old men?
Lo Chen is not young.
I thought you'd say that. She looks about 17, but I suppose you'll tell me she's really a well-preserved 90.
Melanson, she came here in 1884. She's as old as your grandmother.
Conway, you're raving!
You don't believe me?
No, and why should I? Have you ever talked to Lo Chen about her history?
No, as a matter of fact, I haven't.
Conway, you know nothing about this place except what you've been told. You'd hesitate to believe all this guff in an English monastery? Why believe everything just because you're in Tibet?
Well, I suppose we're all inclined to believe those things we find most attractive.
And this stuff about the future war. I'd rather face up to it than bury myself here.
Oh, Melanson, you've a superb knack of misunderstanding me.
We can discuss that in London, Conway. You can spend the rest of your life meditating about it, but not here. Not in this nest of old men waiting about like spiders in a web. Now you've got to act, Conway. There's no time to lose. Are you coming with me? Are you coming with me, Conway?
What Melanson was saying struck me with a great force. For that moment, he had shattered my dream of Shangri-La. I saw it in a different light. For the first time since the war, I had found something to believe in. But now, I wasn't certain anymore.
Come on, Conway, for the last time, man, come on!
Melanson, listen to me. Are you in love with Lo Chen? Really in love?
Well, I know it's absurd. But I can't help my feelings. I'm in love with Lo Chen.
All right, then. I'll help you over the pass.
And what about yourself?
I'm coming too, Melanson. It was surprisingly simple to leave Shangri-La. We just walked away. For Melanson, it was an escape. For me, departure. Now I was a wanderer between two worlds and must forever wander. But for that present in a deepening inward void, all I felt was that I must help Melanson and Lo Chen. I was doomed, like millions of others, to flee from wisdom and be a hero. And on that sad note, I bring my story to an end.
Good heavens, Rutherford, what a spot for Conway to end his story. You say the morning after he told you this, he disappeared?
That's right. The night before our liner pulled into Honolulu, his memory began to come back to him. He told me the whole story, just as you've had it.
Ever think of looking for Shangri-La?
Oh, yes, yes. Altogether, I must have done some thousands of miles. Baskerville, Bangkok, Chungkyang. I visited them all, and somewhere inside the area between them, the mystery lies.
Then there are very few facts.
Too few, I'm sorry to say. 15 months ago, Conway left Baskerville on the 20th of May, and wasn't seen again until he arrived all battered at the Mission Hospital at Chungkyang in October, some 5 months later.
That's curious. Yeah.
And the last we know of his trip into the Northwest is that he left Bangkok on the 3rd of February of this year. All the rest is probability, possibility, guesswork, myth, legend, whatever you like to call it.
I see. But what about the plane? Ever turn up any wreckage or anything?
Not a trace. And the government people at Baskul and Peshawar, well, they don't like to talk about it.
Well, tell me about Mallison. Did you try to find out what happened to him, the Chinese girl?
My dear fellow, of course I did. We'll never know, of course, but it's my guess that Mallison never got out of Tibet alive after meeting the girl on the other side of the pass.
But is there any record of how Conway reached the Mission Hospital at Chungkyang? What did the nuns have to say?
They couldn't exactly remember how Conway came in. But as I was about to give up my cross-examination, one of the nuns remarked, quite casually, that she thought the doctor had said that Conway had been brought in by a woman.
Mallison's girl? Was it Lo Chen?
No. Just a moment. First, I had to track down the Chinese doctor.
Well, what did he say? Did he remember?
Oh, yes. He remembered that Conway had been brought in by a Chinese woman.
Did the doctor fellow remember anything about her?
No, nothing. Except that she'd been ill of the fever herself and had died almost immediately.
Well, so much for that.
Except for one little thing. A question. And I dare say you can guess what it was. I said to him, about this Chinese woman, was she young?
And what was his answer?
Oh, no, he said. She was not young. She was old. Most old of anyone I have ever seen.
Rutherford and I, we sat for a long time in silence. Then we talked again of Conway as I remembered him, boyish and gifted and full of charm, and of the war that had altered him, and of so many mysteries of time and age and of the mind, and of the little Manchu who had been most old, and of the strange ultimate dream of Shangri-La. Do you think he ever found it?
You have heard Lost Horizon by James Hilton, as adapted for radio by Richard E. Davis. Be with us at the NBC Theater next week for a dramatization of Charles Morgan's novel of youth and art, Portrait in a Mirror, and the following week for Miguel de Cervantes' classic work, Don Quixote. Commencing with Don Quixote, the NBC Theater will resume its participation in college-supervised courses in world literature. If you wish to increase your own knowledge and appreciation of the great novels and novelists, we suggest that you write for full information on these correspondence courses. Write to the NBC Theater, care of one of the following universities or colleges: the University of Louisville, Louisville, Kentucky; Kansas State Teachers College, Pittsburgh, Kansas; the University of Tulsa, Tulsa, Oklahoma; Texas College of Arts and Industries, Kingsville, Texas; and Brooklyn College, Brooklyn, New York. Our intermission commentator was James Hilton, whose commentary was recorded. In today's cast, the narrator was Ramsey Hill. Rutherford was Raymond Lawrence. Conway was John Dodsworth. Mallinson was Robin Hughes. Miss Brinklow was Doris Lloyd. Barnard was Nestor Paiva. Chang was Marvin Miller. And the Lama was Stephen Chase. Your announcer, Don Stanley. The NBC Theater is produced by Wade Arnold. The director of the NBC Theater is Andrew C. Love. This program came to you from Hollywood. Three chimes mean good times on NBC. Today marks the return of Theater Guild on the Air to NBC. A sparkling array of the nation's top stars have been signed to appear on Theater Guild this year, and today's return brings Rosalind Russell and Charles Lawton to the Theater Guild stage in Edward, My Son. Today, hear Theater Guild on NBC. This is the National Broadcasting Company.